Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
I'll go into your van, witchy woman.
I'm Nave from Ireland.
And I'm Emily, living in Chicago.
And we have never met in real life.
Fortunately, you don't need to live on the same continent to make a spooky podcast.
So that's exactly what we did. We created Ronan Pine, our folklore, mythology, and spooky stuff podcast.
You can find us on your favorite platform, and we already have over 35 episodes ready to binge.
Don't forget the spooky shorts.
Right. We also have a bunch of short episodes, if that's what you're into.
Come on, get spooky with us, and frick yeah, folklore.
Psst. Hey, you.
Yeah, you.
Are you into weird shit? Yeah?
You into cryptids?
What about hauntings? Yeah, I've got a ghost for you.
Oh, you like overworld the beings.
Me too. Check out all these aliens. We have plenty. How do you feel about a good legend?
Want to hear about spooky happenings?
Yeah, you do.
Let us show you what we've got.
Hey guys, grab a drink and join us, Amanda and Sean, every week while we dive into the strange and haunting topics that have piqued our interest.
See you over at The Haunted and the Strange, wherever you get your podcasts.
Stay spooky.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us once again.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. What are you going to be telling us about today, Mom? Or I guess you should ask me first because you have
yes,
the drink.
I should. I did bring the drink. What story have you got for us today?
I'm going to be talking about Georgia Tan, which I don't think a lot of people have heard of. I certainly haven't heard of it, but it's pretty fucked up. Trigger warning.
Getting a tan in Georgia?
No.
I don't know if I... Okay, what's our trigger warning? If you're mentioning a trigger warning, it's gonna be really bad.
Well, it's not like inherently brutal, but it's just like the context, I guess. Like, it's not a feel-good, happy story.
Okay, well, most of our stories usually aren't. There's a few of them that have been, but most of them aren't.
It involves children, so if you're...
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if you're sensitive to children's stuff, then skip over Declan's part, which will be the second half, because I'm starting. Because I brought the drink, so I get to start. The drink I brought is called the Wildflower, and it is made with lavender sprigs, or if you prefer or you can't find it, mint, pineapple mint, which I didn't know was a thing, or some other herb, pineapple mint. Never heard of it before, personally.
Me neither.
And... the alcohol that's in it is 2 ounces of crisp, dry white wine, such as a Sauvignon Blanc, 1 ounce of elderflower liqueur, 1 ounce of vodka, and club soda. And the steps are to pick a few of the lavender buds from a sprig and muddle it in a highball glass, fill with ice, then add wine, elderflower liqueur, and vodka, top with club soda, and then garnish with a lavender sprig. Or if you're using the other things, then I suppose you could garnish with those other things.
Well, I'm not as lucky as you by having a lavender plant right outside my house, so...
Well, there's that.
I did not include any lavender in my drink, because I don't know where to find it.
I did do the lavender. But I don't know how it's going to go. I don't typically like lavender as a flavor.
Yeah.
So we're going to, we'll see. Are you like ready soap. To?
Or like
it usually cleaning. Does.
Reminds me of soap. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't like wine. So I'm predicting that.
I don't think this is going to be a good drink.
I don't think so either. But we're going to go for it. So let's try it. Nope. Ugh. Nope. Don't like that.
It tastes that's like gross. Medicine.
It does taste like medicine.
That's something people would drink in the 1800s because a doctor said it would cure their cancer or something.
Maybe. I don't know, but that was that was gross. Don't need to ever drink that again. I don't think any of those things go together. I mean, elderflower liqueur and vodka had together. They're typically fine. I like elderflower liqueur. I like vodka. I like club soda. Again, though, I don't like wine and I don't care for lavender. I didn't really taste the lavender too much, though.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't taste it because I didn't put any in mine, but...
Right. I did put quite a few little buds in there because it says to put a few lavender buds. I put probably 7 or 8 little small ones in. I don't know. We'll just say this. If you like lavender, you like wine, you might like this drink. I, however, did not, and I don't need to finish it. So... The reason I chose this drink was for the name Wildflower, because there is a picture of a person that plays a part in this story, and in the picture she is holding flowers. And so I tried to find a drink that had flowers in it. This came up because the picture that she's in, it kind of looks like wildflowers in the picture. And the picture is actually pretty important to finding out some information about her. So not wanting to spoil the story, I'll just say that much.
Okay. So is this a brutal story? Because
this is a. Did we.
Both of my. Like. Well.
This is a brutal story.
So we're recording this week's and next week's episode at the same time. And yes. So I wrote my scripts. They're both like. Both brutal and bizarre. So okay. I just kind of left it as a. Like, okay. I just wanted to get. Like a good understanding of what your story was.
Mine's brutal. There's a little bit of bizarre stuff because it was an unsolved case for a long time. So, I mean, you could factor that in as bizarre, but it is a brutal story.
Okay.
So, we usually start our brutal stories with a little information about the bad guy, the perpetrator. Typically talking about when, where they were born, their childhood, and that kind of fun stuff. Fun in ironic terms. And if we don't start with the perpetrator, then we often talk a little bit about the victim. But this story is going to be a little different because I was not able to find a lot of information about the perpetrator. And he had multiple victims. So we know he had multiple victims. I didn't really want to bring in like the backstory for the victims that we know he had. So it's just a little bit of a different start. So I am going to start with information about the criminal, but don't be holding your breath for any of the typical details about, you know, like his childhood and this happened to him, and I don't have any of that. he was actually kind of hard to find some information, some current information about him. And maybe that's because he likes to use aliases. But I don't know. Our guy in this story is John Kalhauser. He often went by the nickname Jack, which I still don't understand how you get the nickname Jack from a first name John, but that has happened in multiple settings. But so his nickname was Jack. He was born in the mid-1950s. In 1971, Kalhauser was 17 years old and living in Tingsboro, Massachusetts. He was convicted of manslaughter when he shot a man. For that killing, he was sentenced to 7 years, but he only served about a year, and then he was paroled. He didn't stay out of trouble, as they commonly don't. And in 1979, he was involved in another shooting. This time, it was his ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend. So this incident was from a vehicle. He pulled alongside the victim's vehicle and shot several rounds at the man while both were driving down the road. So they're driving down the highway, it sounds like, and he decided to have a shootout from a moving vehicle into another moving vehicle, which seems like not a great idea. Glad that's never happened to me. This victim survived, though, and Kalhauser was charged with armed assault with the intent to murder. He was released from jail on bail a few months later. Around this time, he started dating Brenda Garreau. Brenda was 20 years old, and she lived in Nashua, New Hampshire, a town near the Massachusetts border. So pretty close, but different states. She worked at a convenience store, and she was also a bartender. She was the oldest of her siblings and told her brother Bill that she was moving out west with her boyfriend, Kalhauser. The two left New Hampshire in July 1980. A few weeks later, Brenda called her brother Bill and said she was in Arizona, but would be coming home. She didn't tell him what had happened, but she did not sound like she was very happy. Something was going wrong. And she said, "I'm coming home." And she told him that she didn't want to talk about it, but she would be home soon, and then they would discuss everything. But Brenda never arrived home, and that phone call was the last time anyone heard from her. Bill tried to report his sister missing, but law enforcement wouldn't pursue her as a missing persons case because she was an adult. Basically, they said she had the right to go wherever she wanted, talk to whoever she wanted, and the police weren't going to do anything to list her as missing. She was an adult and could do those things. If she didn't want to be found, they weren't going to find her. And they figured that was, she just decided she didn't want to be in contact with her family anymore. That's what their assumption was. In early April the following year, 1981, a woman's body was found in the Arizona desert. It was clearly a homicide with signs of physical and sexual assault and death by strangulation. The estimated date of death was a couple of days before. There was nothing to identify the victim, and decomposition made identification impossible. Law enforcement had a rough estimate of age, height, and weight, but weren't able to find a missing person case to match the body. They were able to get fingerprints from the body, but that didn't help because she was, you know, the victim had no criminal history. They couldn't identify her for any reason. So she was listed as a Jane Doe. With nothing else to go on at the time, the Doe case went cold. So we're going to fast forward to August of 1995, and I'm going to tell you about another missing person. This person was Diane Van Reith. Diane was a 35-year-old mother of two sons living in Tucson, Arizona. She had recently filed for divorce from her husband. Diane was reported missing when she didn't show up for work. Her vehicle was found abandoned with the keys in it. There wasn't any sign of a struggle, no problems, but there was no sign of Diane either. Just her vehicle with the keys in it on the side of the road. She's missing. Investigators searched for her, but didn't find her. They contacted her estranged husband, Don Stecky, and then learned that he really wasn't anyone by that name. He was living under a fake name, and his real name was John Kalhauser, and he was wanted. Remember back in 1980, when he decided to have a shootout from a moving vehicle, and he got arrested. Well, he jumped bail on that and disappeared. And he was still wanted for those assault charges. So as he was being arrested for the Massachusetts charges, police found a picture of a woman in his possession. She was a young blonde woman holding flowers, the ones that I mentioned before. And he refused to tell them who the woman was. They asked him. He's like, not talking to you. Kalhauser was sent back to Massachusetts to stand trial for the shooting and attempted murder. This trial concluded in November 1996, and he was convicted. He was sentenced to 26 years in prison. In 1999, Diane Van Reith was still missing. She was the woman whose car was found on the side of the road. Nothing ever found of her. She's still missing. Nobody, nothing. Law enforcement and her family believed that she was deceased, even though her body had not been found. Kalhauser was charged with Diane's murder. He ended up pleading no contest for Diane's murder, which meant that he wasn't saying that he committed the crime, but he was saying that he believed he would be convicted if it went to trial. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison for second-degree murder charges on Diane. However, the sentence was to be completed concurrently with his Massachusetts sentence, but the agreement did not allow for any early release, so he was going to serve the full 20 years. But because it was concurrently, he's just serving both sentences at the same time. But if he got let out on early release from Massachusetts, he would still have to serve the 20 years for the Arizona crime. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Either way, he's sitting in there for 20 years. But that's back in 99. So as he's sitting in prison, investigators started working on the Jane Doe case with new technology that was not available at the time that her body was found. In 2012, those remains were exhumed, and through using computer imaging on the skull, they were able to make a digital facial reconstruction. The digital reconstruction was circulated to law enforcement agencies. Investigators believed the reconstruction and the picture of the woman holding the flowers that had been located in Kalhauser's possession could be the same person. Brenda's brother, Bill, was eventually contacted and notified that they might have some information about her. It took some time, but it was eventually confirmed in 2015 that Jane Doe was actually Brenda Garreau. Of course, Kalhauser is now officially a person of interest in her death. Unfortunately, though, he got released from prison in 2019. He had served his 20 years for his estranged wife's murder. And to this date, no one has been charged with anything having to do with Brenda's murder. And Jesus. I tried doing a Google search for this guy and didn't find a lot. There was a Facebook post about Brenda, and they specifically mentioned him and asked if people could provide any, you know, details of where he is or what their relationship was or anything like that. And there's like no new information about him. So it's possible he's out there alive running around under another assumed name. It's also possible he's deceased. I don't know. It's been now 5 years since he was released But yeah, there's no...
How old was he when he was released?
He was born in the 1950s. So
fairly old.
How old would that make him now? Let's pick a... I'm so bad with math things. Let's pick 1955. He would be in his late 60s, early 70s now.
Okay.
So.
Enough. Yeesh.
Mm-hmm.
I hate those unsolved. I mean, I guess it's not really unsolved, but.
Yeah.
No one's been convicted. Like,
exactly. Yeah. I don't love that either. But I liked the story about, you know, I mean, they definitely have a link of the two between the two of them. And if nothing else, her family now knows, you know, where she was and what happened to her and everything. And they're not wondering, thinking, you know, along the police lines of, she just doesn't want to be found and she doesn't want to talk to her family. So.
Yeah.
So this guy definitely has some multiple victims, but.
Not likely he'll be charged for any of them other than that first one.
Well, yeah, the one, yeah. I mean, he served the manslaughter one when he was 17. He got the attempted manslaughter from Massachusetts from the shootout, his estranged wife, and yeah, but it doesn't look like he's going to, I mean, who knows if he'll do anything for Brenda. If he's even still alive, I don't know.
Okay, let's talk about this Georgia Tan case.
Okay.
Georgia was born in 1891 to Balua and George Tan, with a younger brother being introduced when she was only 3 years old. So she's 3 years older than her brother.
This is an old case.
Her father then. Had... Yes, it's... This was before, I think...
Old.
This wouldn't be able to happen nowadays, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Her father had aspirations of Georgia becoming a concert pianist, so he forced her to practice piano religiously. After high school, Georgia attended Martha Washington College and graduated with a degree in music. Shortly after that, she went to Columbia and later passed the bar exam to become a lawyer, as her father was. Despite her legal certification, her father did not want her to become a lawyer, so she looked towards social work. She got a job at the Kate McWillie Powers Receiving Home for Children, where she was the director of receiving. A family friend, Ann Atwood, also worked there, and the two became close. During her time there, Georgia adopted a daughter named June. Ann and Georgia started a relationship, so when Georgia was fired for improper child placement, her and Ann moved to Tennessee together. Georgia was hired at the Tennessee Children's Home Society as executive secretary. Shortly after her hire, she became the director of the house. I guess the laws in Tennessee at the time prevented the selling of children, so when a child was adopted, the receiving family would only pay the service charge to accommodate the office work, like, needed to place the child, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
So it's not like when you go and adopt a dog, like, you pay for the dog itself.
The adoption fees.
Yes. So it was pretty much just covering the administration work needed to place the kid, which was about $7 at the time.
Well, I'm glad that you know, it was illegal to sell children. That's a good law to have. I mean, let's just not change that law.
However, what Georgia implemented into the house wasn't quite legal. Georgia created a private adoption program which allowed out-of-state families to adopt children at a premium price.
Oh, so she gave them a discount?
No. The opposite. She would charge more for, like, out-of-staters. I don't think
okay.
it was quite legal for out-of-staters to come and adopt a child in Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
So she set it up so that they could adopt. Like
they could do that, but they had to pay extra.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Almost 80% of adoptions were coming from people in New York and California, earning Georgia $5,000 per adoption, which is a lot more than $7.
And so this was in what year time frame?
In like the 30s.
Okay.
In like the 30s to 40s. Like
so $5,000 in 1940. Let's see what that is.
So I'll get into like the conversion later in the story.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Yeah, she made a profit, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Woof.
So Alma Watson and Regina Werner were in charge of sending these kids to like where they needed to go. So they would make trips every 3 weeks, each carrying 4 to 6 babies with them at a time. And each person was in charge of a different area, California and New York being where most of these out-of-state adoptions came from.
Okay.
So one of them would go to New York with 4 to 6 babies. The other one would go to California with 4 to 6 babies.
Okay. Yikes. That's a lot of babies.
Yeah. They would rent hotel rooms to set up almost like a shopping center for wealthy families. So the families would come in and pick out the baby they wanted. Yeah.
Oh, good God.
When it came time to sign the check, Georgia would charge them for background checks that were never actually checked, exorbitant airline fees, and would charge 5 times the normal adoption rate. Georgia created a hidden bank account where all the checks were deposited, taking in 80 to 90% of the profits. Because she'd throw the two people taking the babies a little bit of money, but she profited almost all of it.
Wow.
One of the children adopted out of state turned out to be a very famous wrestler that a lot of us probably know by the name of Ric Flair.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know that name.
Yeah.
And I'm not even like a wrestling fan.
Me,
but I know the name.
I don't like WWE, but everybody knows Ric Flair. Woo!
Right. Woo! Yeah.
Now, Georgia wasn't just given a child and told to find a home for the child. Georgia would find poor single mothers and pressure or coerce them into giving their child, to which she would sell the child to a family in New York for almost 700 times the money she would make from a legal adoption. Because if the child was adopted illegally, she'd make $7.
Right.
That's it.
$7. Wow. I was wondering if you were going to say where the babies came from. Because I mean, you're taking 4 to 6 babies to each state. Okay.
Yeah.
This is gross.
Georgia also had connections to state institutions. So when a child was born in like a mental health institution or a prison, mm-hmm. she would automatically be granted the child to help meet like her demands.
No.
Yeah.
Yuck.
In Tennessee, the local health organization had met with several homes for unwed mothers to make sure that the children were required to stay with the mother for at least 3 months or until they were done breastfeeding. Because like when you're a baby, that kind of thing, like like it makes your chances of being a normal human so much higher.
Right. Yeah.
Like we could see with Ted Kaczynski, you can't be left alone for 4 months and without human contact.
Right.
However, all the homes reported that Georgia would come in and take the children just weeks after they were born due to court commitments. Quote.
Yuck.
Yeah.
I don't like this lady. I hope you get to tell me something bad happened to her.
I wish I could say that. So, reports from the local hospital showed that Georgia would take the kids from their mothers who weren't even released from the hospital yet.
I've
never given birth, but I assume it's like a day or two that you sit in the hospital just kind of getting shit checked out.
So it depends on the health of the child, the health of the mother as well. I think currently the average stay is like overnight or, you know, a day or two. But I'm not sure how it was back in the 30s and 40s. It might have been longer that they held people in there and kept them in there. Now it seems like they just, you know, want to get in and out. And
like, I mean, I don't think the practices were as great back then, so they might have had to keep them longer or something. But
could be.
Anyway, she was getting newborn babies.
Oh God.
She would also take babies from unwed mothers, claiming that the baby needed medical attention, but when the mothers came looking for their babies, they would claim that they passed away.
She's a monster.
There were also circumstances where mothers would take their kids to daycare, only to find out that, quote-unquote, welfare agents had taken the child while it was actually just Georgia.
Oh, my God. No one's safe.
Nope, no one is. Georgia would often alter or destroy the records of a child who was being shipped out of state, which led to child the Child Welfare League of America dropping them from their list of qualified institutions. If receiving families would question the falsified medical records of their new adoption, Georgia would use her friend, Judge Camille Kelly, to legally threaten the adoptive families. Georgia had friends in high places.
Yeah.
The judge would also help Georgia by serving custody of divorced mothers, requiring that the children be placed in Georgia's care. However, it was discovered that a majority of these children would be sold to farms for, like, extra work hands.
For labor? Yes. My God. This just keeps getting worse, Declan.
It is. That's why I had a trigger warning on it.
It is. It's just getting worse.
Many of the children in Georgia's care would be neglected, abused physically or sexually, and even some being murdered.
Oh my God. Of course.
During her time at the home in Memphis. During her time at the home, Memphis had the highest infant mortality rates in the nation, largely contributed to Georgia.
Of course.
Georgia would hire underqualified nurses to care for the babies, who would often sedate difficult babies or allow them to die of malnutrition.
Oh my God.
Yeah. She would often disregard doctor's orders, which led to the death of a suspected 500 babies.
My God. God.
Yeah. In September of 1950, an investigation was launched on the home and determined that Georgia personally profited around $1 million, or about $18 million in today's currency.
Jesus.
However, Georgia died from cancer 8 days after the investigation was launched and 3 days before the state was going to prosecute her. So she escaped that punishment just in the nick of time.
Oh, man. I hope her death was... I
hope she's rotting in hell.
painful and unrelenting. Like, I hope she bled out of her eyeballs.
Like, that's some Jeffrey Epstein shit.
That is just...
That's fucked up.
Atrocious.
Yeah.
Yuck.
Yeah, not a good story.
No.
Well, do you have a chaser to make things all better?
My chaser. So, normally, my chaser is the Olympics. It's very broad.
Okay.
I don't normally watch the Olympics, but I have had not a lot of other things to watch. And so I've been watching just random events and seeing the different things, stuff that I've never seen before. Like we watched the
break dancing and skateboarding.
Oh, the break dancing. It was like the quarterfinals.
The Australian. The Australian girl, she's just spinning around on the like walking on the ground like you did as a kid, like spinning in circles.
Yeah, it's bad. Like, I don't, we didn't see that one in particular. I know what meme you're talking about or which video, but we were watching the I think it was like quarterfinals, and I don't remember what country it was in the U.S. U.S. was going against, and the U.S. was like, you could identify it as what you would assume is breakdancing. The other country, the guy, like some of his moves look like breakdancing, but other moves just look like he fell down. It was so awkward and bizarre, and I just watched it going, this can't really be an Olympic sport where this person just literally looked like they fell down and then flopped around like a dead fish on the ground. It was so bizarre. It was so bizarre. But we watched the finale of the modern pentathlon, the men's modern pentathlon, and that was kind of cool to watch because they run like the end of it is a 600 meter run that they have to do six times, and in between each lap they have to shoot a laser pistol at a laser target, and they have to get five hits before they can start running again.
What?
Yeah.
They're playing laser tag at the Olympics?
Kind of. Yeah. There's a laser. There's a laser.
So weird.
Like shooting range, and they have to shoot and hit five targets or hit the target five times before they can do their next lap.
That's weird.
Yeah. So, I mean, the shooting part itself, not dynamic at all. And you're just standing there watching a person shoot a laser pistol. But then when they drop it and start running again, or they're still shooting, I mean, it was just kind of interesting and to see that. So yeah, that's my random chaser, that there's some interesting there's some interesting sports out there.
Stuff at the Olympics, yeah.
Some weird stuff, yeah. What's your chaser?
My chaser is an Instagram account. It's called Christian Petroni. It's spelled exactly as how it sounds.
Okay.
And he... So you've probably seen him before, because he was one of the guest judges on Chopped, and he ended up being on Chopped a fuck ton. He's like a bald guy. He's Italian, but he makes like, he'll do cooking videos on his Instagram, and they're shot so well, and he's like an actual chef, and so the food looks amazing too. I just like to get lost on his Instagram and just watch him make delicious Italian food, because I guess he would go to Italy as a child. His family lived there. So, like, every summer he'd go there. And he'd be like, my nonna every summer would make this for me in Italy. Like,
nice.
It's a really good, just waste some time Instagram. That makes
sense.
Does
he have, like, recipes so you could, like, see him make it and then go, that looks really good and I want to make the same thing, or attempt to duplicate it? Or is it like, this is just yummy food and it's delicious and you don't even know what's in it?
it shows him making it. He doesn't have like a recipe list. He'll just make a video. Like the most recent one he did was fried calamari, like sandwich po' boy style.
Oh,
so like,
okay.
It doesn't list off, oh, 4 cups of flour or whatever, but like, yeah. He'll show you what he's doing. And if you know how to cook, you can figure it out. But
okay.
He doesn't have like listed recipes with the stuff. He just kind of like tells a little story and shows him making this delicious looking food.
Well, I'm all about food. You know that.
Yeah. But yeah, nice. That's my chaser. Everyone who likes to make themselves hungry by looking at Instagram videos, go check that out.
All the time.
I'm very guilty of that.
Yes.
I'll do that on my break at work, because my Instagram feed is pretty much just like funny just videos and people food. Cooking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode, Mom.
It does.
Enjoyed hearing your story, even though neither one of ours were particularly.
No, they weren't great.
Good.
No, they didn't have good endings at all.
No.
Hopefully next week we'll have better endings to our stories. I can't even remember what I'm.
It's not great if you like animals, but.
Oh, good no.
Good if you like people. It's about animals that eat people, so.
Oh, shit. I hope we're not doing the same story. I guess we'll find out next week.
Uh-oh. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Love you, bud.
Love you, too. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.